Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You're not going to believe this, gang, but Alan Greenspan, he blew it. Seriously, the housing crash, the recession blew the whole thing. Said so himself just today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 23rd of October. Glad to have you with us as the fallout from the financial crisis continues to shape the U.S. economy. Victim number one on this particular day might well be the reputation of Alan Greenspan, and we will get to that in just a minute. 6 or so weeks into the crisis, the government's bailout team has turned its attention to the proximate cause of most of the misery, the mortgage market. Their partial rescue plan coming up. And I know it's painful to open your retirement statements nowadays, but you might be sorry if you don't. But let us start today by talking about mortgages, by relaying this grim fact that came out. RealtyTrack reported this morning that foreclosure filings nationwide rose 71% last quarter over the same time last year. So our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the feds are working on an offer that lenders aren't going to be able to refuse.
The Federal Housing Administration already guarantees new loans to borrowers facing foreclosure if the lender agrees to reduce the outstanding principal. But at a Senate Banking Committee hearing today, New York Democrat Charles Schumer told FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair that's not working.
Do you have any hope for a voluntary model? I don't.
No, there needs to be a package of carrot and stick incentives. I agree with that.
For the carrot, Bair says she's working with the Treasury Department to offer mortgage lenders federal loan guarantees if they agree to easier terms for homeowners who can't afford their mortgage payments.
The aim is for loan servicers to offer homeowners more affordable and sustainable mortgages.
The stick is banks lose money on foreclosed properties. Bair says the FDIC has already helped 3,500 borrowers who held mortgages with the failed thrift IndyMac, which FDIC took over this year. Bair wants the reduction of mortgage payments to around a third of a family's monthly earnings to be a standard. Eric Halperin with the Center for Responsible Lending agrees a standard is necessary.
What we need is a program of mass modifications that allow us to do modifications quickly. This individualized approach of voluntary actions by lenders doing modifications one at a time simply can't keep up with the number of homes that are going into foreclosure.
The Wall Street Journal estimates the loan guarantees would cost $40 billion, and that would come out of the $700 billion bailout. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Yeah, that line from Casablanca is horribly overused, the one about being shocked to find gambling going on in Rick's Cafe. But Alan Greenspan trotted out a version of it today. The former Fed chairman said he is, quote, shocked at the meltdown of U.S. credit markets and that he'd made some mistakes in his belief about deregulation. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
What a difference nearly 3 years makes.
The impressive performance of the U.S. economy over the past couple of decades offers clear evidence of the benefits of increased market flexibility.
That was Alan Greenspan speaking in late 2005. Here's what he told the House Oversight Committee today.
Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity are in a state of shocked disbelief.
Yeah, it was typical Greenspan speak.
Morris Davis is a former Fed economist, now at the University of Wisconsin.
It looks like he had perfect foresight at the time, but the truth of the matter is I think he was ignoring a lot of people that suggested that there might be a big problem.
Davis says Greenspan did get conflicting advice, but some economists warned him that the housing market could collapse. So was Greenspan genuinely surprised? Yes, says Douglas Diamond. He teaches finance at the University of Chicago and consults for the Fed.
Well, I think he had a very simple view of the world that free markets always provided very good incentives.
Today, Greenspan avoided taking personal responsibility for the crisis, but he did say it was a mistake to assume that banks would stay out of trouble to protect their shareholders. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Layoffs are rapidly becoming a through line in the story of the post-bailout economy. Goldman Sachs, Xerox, and both Chrysler and General Motors announced job cuts today. GM announced some other belt-tightening, too, to employee benefits. The company is going to temporarily stop matching employee contributions to its 401k program. Granted, GM is hurting worse than most. It's lost more than $57 billion over the past couple of years. But might other struggling companies now follow suit? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story.
This has happened before, at GM a couple times in 2001, at Ford in the 90s, and at a handful of companies during the dot-com bust. But Ed Ferrigno of the industry group Profit-Sharing 401k Council of America says match suspensions are still pretty rare.
I think in the last 10 years, I would say probably less than a dozen.
All the instances he can remember have been temporary. He says there may be more on the way because 401k matches are seen as a flexible item on balance sheets.
The flexibility is a factor in deciding whether to offer the plan in the first place. And it could boil down to a decision between laying off workers and suspending the 401k match.
Companies that match 401k contributions usually put in about 50 cents for every dollar the employee does. Gerald Myers is the former CEO of American Motors. He says he often thought about cutting 401k matches to save money, but never did it.
In my experience, we generally avoided taking this step because it's such a morale buster.
He says companies that stop contributing risk losing their best employees, even in a weak job market. Still, some think more will follow GM's lead if economic conditions worsen. Rick Meggs is the president of 401kHelpCenter.com.
GM has now broken the ice. Therefore, other companies are going to be a lot freer to suspend their own matches.
What's most worrying about that, analysts say, is that without the match, employees may stop contributing to their 401ks altogether. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street was up, down, and all around today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All those reports of credit default swaps being the most recent sign of the financial apocalypse? Never mind. There were predictions of hundreds of billions in losses due to Lehman Brothers swaps when that company went bankrupt. But it turns out, probably not as many billions as everybody predicted. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the update.
In the end, just over $5 billion changed hands to settle Lehman Brothers credit default swaps. That's according to the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation. The DTCC's Frank DeMaria says his company tracks the vast majority of those transactions.
I would think that should give market participants some comfort that there is order and discipline to the credit default swap market as opposed to some of the things that have been portrayed recently in the press.
He's talking about the fear that settling the Lehman swaps could have cost banks, hedge funds, and insurance companies in the hundreds of billions of dollars. The swaps are like insurance that pays out when a company defaults on its debt. So how did we get it so wrong? Industry reps say many institutions both bought and sold insurance on Lehman bonds, essentially canceling out their positions. But skeptics question whether the DTCC has the full story. They say the market is unregulated, so buyers and sellers of swaps don't have to report their trades. Chris Whalen is managing director of Institutional Risk Analytics. He says what started as an insurance contract turned into a bet on a company's solvency.
This activity has no economic basis. It's just people gambling. So whether or not it worked out okay or not, to me, is really not the point. The real point is whether or not we should allow our banks to be participating in this market.
Whalen believes some dealers may be hiding their exposure to credit default swap losses, and the real fallout may be yet to come. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let's go down the list of companies the Federal Reserve has bailed out, just to refresh our memories here for a second. We got Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AIG. Those are just the ones we know by name, of course. Because over the past year or so, the Fed has pumped hundreds of billions of dollars in straight cash into the banking system. And as the financial crisis has worsened, Mr. Bernanke has said he'll shell out hundreds of billions more in loans and special financing programs. Add it all up, and altogether, the Fed could be on the hook for an estimated $1.4 trillion. To find out where all that cash is coming from, Rico Galliano has the first installment of our new explainer series, The Marketplace Decoder.
Remember back in March? Good times. The election was still far enough away to ignore. Unemployment was a merely lousy 5.1% compared to September's awful 6.1%. And the Federal Reserve?
The Federal Reserve was sitting on a huge stash of Treasury bills. That was their biggest investment, about $800 billion in Treasury bills that they bought on the secondary market.
That's Marketplace senior editor and one of our resident Fed experts, Patty Hirsch. He says the Fed kept that $800 billion on hand to sell when it needed cash, for stuff like controlling the nation's money supply, a rainy day fund, if you will. Then, Tropical Storm Bear Stearns hit, followed by hurricanes Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Lehman. Rainy day fund in effect.
From March through September, the Fed was selling off those Treasury bills that it had and using the money to buy other stuff, you know, to help out Bear Stearns, to extend other kinds of loans that it had never made before. So by about mid-September, it had blown through about $350 billion.
Okay, so that's where some of the bailout money came from. But this well has run dry. The Fed needs the remaining 400 plus billion bucks in case of apocalypse, otherwise known as rampant inflation. But since September, the government pledged at least a trillion more in bailout money and other aid. So, Patty, where's that cash coming from?
Well, Rico, that's coming from the Fed's magic ATM machine.
Yes, the magic ATM machine. You can find it in Ben Bernanke's office, guarded by cute but powerful elves. He inserts a jewel-encrusted wizard card, and out pop debt-free dollars made of purest gold. No, not really. Marilyn Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management.
The money has to come not out of thin air, but from the U.S. Treasury. And since they don't have a surplus, they have a deficit, they will print Treasury notes and Treasury bonds and sell them to small investors, to large institutional investors, and to foreigners.
Create IOUs, in other words, more than $500 billion worth so far. That, of course, puts us further into debt. How much further depends on how many more IOUs they sell and on how much interest they have to pay to get people to buy. Obviously, the Treasury will try to keep rates low.
And if nobody shows up or very few show up, then it means that it was priced wrong. That means that interest rates will have to go up, and that will be very bad for an economy that is declining like ours is now.
For the time being, though, many buyers are showing up. Why? Apparently, they believe we're still one of the safest bets out there. Jos Warso is Senior Executive VP at Union Bank of California.
There's continuously lots of appetite to buy U.S. Treasuries. They're going to issue Treasuries. They're doing that. Typically very short-term bills at this point in time, paying 1-2%.
The Treasury hands cash from those sales to the Fed, which Warsaw says then lends it to banks at rates as high as 7%. So assuming enough banks survive, the Fed could make money in the long term. But in the short term, trust me, you don't want to look at that ATM receipt. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. After swinging around all day, the Dow Industrials rose 2%, 172 points, to close at 8,691. The NASDAQ, on the other hand, gave back 0.75%, 11 points, ended at 1603. The S&P 500 split the difference, picked up 1.25%, also 11 points, closed at 908. Poor corporate profits and fears of recession ruled again. Goldman Sachs shares tumbled more than 5.25% today on those reports that it's going to lay off 10% of its workers. General Motors stock drove down 1.5% on news that more white-collar jobs could be cut. The big news, though, came after the Bell software giant Microsoft reported a 2% rise in quarterly profits. That sent its shares surging as much as 5% after the close. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Who can you trust? The banks? Our elected officials? Financial advisors? That question and more this weekend on a special Marketplace Money show dedicated to America's financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. The National Association of Realtors releases the September report on existing home sales. The Brookings Institution holds a discussion on U.S. counterterrorism strategies for the future. And on this day in 1861, the first transcontinental telegraph line was completed, putting the Pony Express out of business. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. With today's new mortgage plan from the FDIC, there is some hope for homeowners staring down the barrel of foreclosure in this economy. As John Dimsdale was telling us, the $40 billion it's going to cost will come out of the original pool of bailout money. But commentator and economist Andrew Kaplan says helping troubled homeowners doesn't necessarily need those oceans of government cash. He says it can be done using a type of mortgage developed 40 years ago, but never really widely used.
In most parts of the country, house prices are plummeting. Families are defaulting on their mortgages and being kicked out of their homes. That's bad news for them, but also for us, because bonds issued on the backs of those mortgages are being bought by the government as part of the Wall Street bailout. The more borrowers who default, the less those bonds, our bonds, are worth. Future taxpayers, our children, are being condemned to a subprime future. But there is a way out of this mess. Meet Sam. Sam is a shared appreciation mortgage where the lender and the borrower essentially become stakeholders in a house and where both profit when a home increases in value. Sam can reduce defaults and loan losses and give us taxpayers a fighting chance of coming out on top. Here's how. Imagine a family that took out a $200,000 mortgage but can only afford payments on a loan three-quarters that size. The hole they're in gets deeper when the value of the house falls. Rather than repossess the house, the lender can opt to refinance the mortgage with $150,000 Sam. That way, the lender gets something in exchange for the write-down, a significant share of any future appreciation in the house. So if 5 years later the house is sold into a recovered market for $200,000, the lender would get an appropriate share of that profit. If we allowed Sam in this country, taxpayers would get a share of the appreciation in any houses that got written down. This would reduce the odds of the homeowner defaulting and increase the value of those bonds that you and I now own. Tragically, as useful as SAMs could be to our economy, we can't use them. The IRS imposed a block on SAMs nearly 40 years ago. But that block could be lifted with the stroke of the Treasury Secretary's pen. Henry Paulson should pick that pen up and save our children from a subprime future.
Andrew Kaplan is a professor of economics at New York University. Your thoughts are always welcome. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on that link that says contact. If you wanted to market a book about companies making stupid decisions that wind up costing them and their shareholders billions of dollars, well, you couldn't really pick a better time than right about now, could you? And while the losses in the headlines are mostly coming from the financial industry, plenty of other companies have made plenty of other stupid decisions that have cost them plenty of money. Paul Carroll and Chuck Amui explore those decisions and the logic behind them in their new book, Billion Dollar Lessons. Glad to have you both with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's define our terms here right up at the top. Are we talking about niggling little problems, or are we talking about company-killing failures here? Paul?
We're talking about big ones. We're talking bankruptcies of companies with more than $500 million of assets. We're talking about huge write-offs. We're talking about companies that had to sell because they were about to get clobbered.
Chuck, let me ask you this question, though. These CEOs are, for the most part, very smart people advised by very smart and well-paid consultants. How is it that they drive these companies into the ground? What patterns did you find?
Well, we found that a number of the failures, a large number of the failures,
were due to strategic errors.
Paul, is there a favorite category of failure that you guys found?
Probably my favorite was what we called stay the course. You'd have companies that were facing significant threats like Kodak, which had its very profitable traditional film business being threatened by digital photography, and yet they somehow managed to ignore those threats long enough to really be hurt.
Explain that a little bit more. It's not that they just ignored it. I mean, they in fact did things that were not beneficial to them, right?
Right, and that's a very common problem. Companies just can't quite pull themselves away from a traditional business that's been profitable, even though they know that that profitability is going to go away.
The other thing we hear about in corporate mergers gone bad is this word synergy, right? That, oh, yeah, we're going to get all these benefits out of working together. But somehow, Chunka, that just doesn't seem to come true, right?
A large number of our failures were due to essentially over-expectations of what you're buying without enough consideration of the difficulties you get along with that.
When you're talking about synergies, though, is it a flawed process somewhere in the middle? Does somebody look at it and say, this could work, and then it goes awry in the planning process? I mean, what happens?
What typically happens is that people overemphasize the positives and leave out the negatives. They're entranced by the idea of developing scale, but they forget they're also developing complexity. They're buying problems as well as assets.
The one that came to my mind, actually, when I was reading this book was, at the time, the biggest corporate merger ever, AOL and Time Warner. Classic example, right, Paul?
Absolutely. I mean, they assumed that they could get these upstart online college kid types from AOL to work with this very staid, serious, longtime organization that did these magazines. And they just didn't want to work together.
Given that CEOs probably don't want to hear much about business failures and so might not read this book, Chunka, let me ask you what your takeaway is for everyday readers. I mean, you read this book, what do you want us to go away with?
If you're the person sitting inside that company, I think the thing we want to take away is that whether you're in the middle, near the top, or at the very top, you have to say, well, is it worthwhile to step back and take another look at this great idea that we have?
Paul, what about you? What's your takeaway from this book?
There's a story we tell in the book about the ancient Persians who would always make decisions twice, once when they were sober and once when they were drunk.
Well, one came first?
Well, it's interesting. When we tell that story to business audiences, everybody laughs and says, okay, let's go to the bar and talk about this some more. But in fact, businesses, because of the emotion that goes into setting strategy, because of all the socialization that happens with the strategy, are actually in an emotional state that is somewhat like being drunk when they typically make a decision. So what we're saying is that people ought to step back and in a very sober moment, reevaluate these things.
The book by Paul Carroll and Chunka Moy is called Billion Dollar Lessons. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Chunka Moy, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Did you see the campaign finance reports that came out earlier this week? Barack Obama collected an eye-popping $150 million last month. A validation, I suppose you could say, of his change of heart when he decided to opt out of the public financing system. But it does present him and his staff with this question. How do you spend it all? He is going to blow $3 million next Wednesday to buy some national television time. And half an hour on three of the four major networks doesn't come cheap. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that even when he's trying by doing things like that, it's tough for Obama to spend what he's got.
Senator Barack Obama's campaign is swimming in cash, but there's a problem.
This is a you can't take it with you proposition. In other words, this money's no good to him after Election Day.
Evan Tracy runs the Campaign Media Analysis Group. His job is to track political ad buys. And right now, he says in most of the competitive states around the country, there's very little local advertising time left for Obama to buy. Consider this.
The Chicago problem. Senator Obama is spending about $500,000 a week right now on Chicago TV.
Obama's not afraid of losing Chicago. He's buying ads there to reach voters across the border in Indiana.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
He's buying ads in Boston to reach New Hampshire.
Senator Obama, I am not President Bush.
True, but you did vote with Bush 90% of the time.
tech.
These are some of the most expensive media markets in America, and most of the people watching are voting in states Obama's already locked up. But he's spending lavishly there anyway just to reach a small slice of the audience.
His message is going everywhere.
Tracy says with money to burn, buying a half hour on prime time makes all the sense in the world for Obama, even though it's been almost a generation since a candidate bought this kind of time on network TV. Remember Ross Perot?
Well, let's get right to work.
And his pie charts?
We're $4.1 trillion in debt.
His half-hour political infomercials didn't exactly set a ratings record or change the course of history. But Shanto Iyengar, director of Stanford University's Political Communications Lab, says Obama's challenge today is totally different than Perot's was 16 years ago.
The elephant in the room in this entire discussion is the question of race.
Iyengar says for weeks, the McCain campaign's message has been focused on making Americans just a bit uneasy about his Democratic opponent.
Who is Barack Obama?
Obama's half hour on prime time is his best chance to erase these doubts.
Senator Obama's going to try and convey more of an emotional connection.
Think FDR in his fireside chats, reassuring Americans with a strangely familiar message.
But if there is any family in the United States about to lose its home or its farm, that family should telegraph at once.
If Obama can create that kind of intimate connection with voters, Evan Tracy says the payoff could be enormous. But he adds there's one potential pitfall. So much time on TV might smack of entitlement.
If there's any risk in this Obama half-hour special, it is that backlash. It could potentially give sympathy to McCain.
After all, Obama's half-hour chat will delay the opening pitch of Game 6 of the World Series. One Republican summed it up this way. Obama's putting politics ahead of the national pastime. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes today, and I have to tell you this first item generated some discussion at our morning meeting today. Apparently, the secondary market in funeral plots is getting stronger as the economy tightens. That is, people who've already bought themselves plots but now find themselves needing some extra cash. Forbes.com did the original reporting. The website says most of those doing the selling are fixed-income seniors in their 60s and 70s. Depending on where you choose to spend eternity, a final resting place can cost thousands of dollars or a whole lot more. And this today from New York City. The city council has gone along with Mayor Michael Bloomberg. The council voted today to change the rules to let the mayor run for a third term. Probably doesn't hurt that now council members themselves can run for a third term as well. No extra time for us, though. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow shook off 172 points. That's about 2%. The Nasdaq fell 11 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 rose 11 points. That's 1.25% there. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Join us tomorrow and join us early for more of Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis on the Marketplace Morning Report. And coming up next time on this program, British banks feel the pain.
People in this country, as opposed to the United States, feel that they can borrow up to their limit because ultimately their old age is underwritten by the government.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.